This episode is brought to you by Pizza Trocadero, the finest pizzeria in all of Guelph, Ontario. They've got delicious gourmet pizzas, or choose from an array of fresh ingredients and make whatever you like. Calzones, wings, panzerotti, salads, breadsticks, garlic bread. Pizza Trocadero has it all. You can find them at 7 Municipal Street in Guelph, or visit them online at trocaderoguelph.ca. That's TrocaderoGuelph.ca. Call them at 519-829-2444 for pickup or delivery. That's Pizza Trocadero, a place of the good trade. Coming up at the Starlight in Waterloo, Ontario, Emmanuel Jal and Tanika Charles appear together on December 4th, and Tokyo Police Club, Said the Whale, and the Pack AD perform on December 9th and 10th. Unfortunately, the December 5th show featuring GZA of Wu-Tang Clan has been canceled, and refunds are available at point of purchase. The Starlight is located at 47 King Street in Waterloo. For complete listings and information, visit starlightsocialclub.ca. Tell the truth, confuse that liar. I take my rights even higher. I'll throw my hands in the air. I salute if you care. I'll throw my hands in the
air. Creative Control with Vish Khanna.
What happened? My daughter. I have a daughter. She was born on December 2nd at 4:09 a.m. 4:09. Around 3:15 a.m., I'm awoken by my wife, and she says, I think something's happening. And less than an hour later, Ramona. We have a daughter named Ramona, and she's wonderful. And it was very dramatic and rapid. That's a short amount of time. That's a short labor, if you don't know. And it was a little stressful, I will say. The midwives did not arrive at our home until 4:08 a.m., and Ramona was born at 4:09. So it was a lot of us doing a lot of everything and not really sure if we were doing it right. But apparently, we're fine. Ramona's great. Sleeping a lot. Eating a lot. My wife is not sleeping so much. I am not sleeping so much, but a bit more than her. She's doing a lot of feeding and whatnot. But things are good. Things are well. It's busy around here. My wife's parents are around, and it's been busy. But good. So I just want to tell you that. I'm very happy. Things are good. And before I went and picked up Michelle's parents at the airport, I went to Toronto to talk to Kevin Howes and Duke Redbird about this new beautiful compilation, Native North America Volume 1. I'm just going to get the thing so I get the second part of this title right. Aboriginal Folk Rock and Country 1966 to 1985. I'm holding it in my hands, the double CD. I think the vinyl is en route to me, and I am so excited about this thing. It sounds great. It is a collection of rare, scarcely heard music made by Indigenous people in this country of Canada. And Volume 2, as I understand it, promises to feature people from America, the United States of America. And you'll learn about that and more on a very revealing and interesting chat with both Kevin and Duke Redbird. Kevin is the compiler, the curator of this thing. He lives in Vancouver. He's worked with this record label, Light in the Attic Records, before, compiling things for them, finding things. He's just an avid, super wise record collector, and most of this material is from his collection, and it's been transferred into this compilation. Duke Redbird is a very noted poet, bit of a Renaissance man. He does all sorts of things. He's a motivational speaker. He's a poet. He contributed a poem to and produced a track called Silver River, which you're going to hear from this compilation. Anyway, I am just making stuff up here as I go along. I don't want to get anything wrong. I think you should hear from these two gentlemen and go to lightintheattic.net for more information about how to order this thing, because I think you'll want to. It's beautiful. Here it is, Kevin and Duke Redbird. I might take a nap. That's what we do now. When you have two kids, you feel like taking naps.
Creative Control. Kazoo and Keep Your Eyes Open are pleased to present State of the Mall 13, a festive music festival that benefits the Canadian Cancer Society towards leukemia research. Night 1 takes place Thursday, December 11th at Silence and features performances by Jennifer Castle, John Southworth, and Shopkeeper. Night 2 takes place Friday, December 12th at the E-Bar with Mets, Weaves, and Badminton Racket. Silence is an accessible venue at 46 Essex Street. The E-Bar is located at 41 Quebec Street, but has stairs and is regrettably not a physically accessible space. Tickets to both all-ages licensed shows are available at ticketbreak.com, or bring a non-perishable food item to the bookshelf at 41 Quebec Street, or to the door and save $2 off admission. Learn more about Stay Out of the Mall 13 at their Facebook event page. See you all there. Yellow side road.
Duke is going to join us soon?
I think he wants to win this pool game badly, but he's supposed to join us.
Okay. He's really, is he a big deal? Do you know him
well?
Exciting
place, yeah. I'm starting to. And he's a lovely man. And he painted that pool table.
Really?
Yeah. It's something to take a closer look at afterwards.
I didn't know that he... look at that. That's lovely, actually.
Yeah, it's really cool. A lot of... characters and faces and color.
He just did an animated swoop of his cue there. I think he's gonna win. I have a feeling he's gonna win. He's close to the end of there.
The first time I met Duke, we came here and I actually beat him in pool. But I was like,
feel like you may have been a bad guest.
Well, you got to go for it, you know.
Yeah. Well, ask Duke more about the space when he comes by.
Most definitely, no. Yeah. He's a fantastic. Well, he's a multidisciplinary artist.
He's a bit of a poet. Renaissance man, isn't he?
Very much.
Incredibly.
Yeah. They do still exist, and he is living proof.
Now, you and I don't know each other super well. You're living in Vancouver.
Not yet. I live in Vancouver. Yes. In British Columbia.
And what's your background exactly? You've produced. Essentially, this compilation that we're here to talk about, Native North America, Volume 1.
Yes.
What is your musical background?
Well, I was raised in a music-loving family. I was born in 1974 in Richmond Hill, Ontario. My parents had a record collection. My dad played in high school dance bands in Montreal in the 60s, so I was surrounded with music. My dad and mom had a record collection filled with some great music. Beatles, Rolling Stones, Muddy Waters, Otis Redding, mm-hmm. Jimi Hendrix. So these things turned me on. It got me excited about music at a young age. And in the 1990s, I started DJing as sort of an outgrowth of my love of hip-hop and rap music. Yeah, loving rap music.
So not just like DJing a party, you were actually getting into the art of turntablism? Like, were you DJing?
Well, this is sort of in the mid-1990s. So basically in the late 80s is the era that I really started getting into music on a deeper level. Started out with radio and then going to record stores and buying tapes and eventually vinyl records. You know, initially I'd buy stuff like The Clash or Bob Marley or The Sex Pistols, The Specials, English Beat, like a wide range of stuff. Mm-hmm. Things I was excited about, getting into Public Enemy, Maestro Fresh West, Main Source, Big Daddy Kane, you know, the rap music of late 80s, early 90s.
What was it? You mentioned a bunch of sort of punk bands, new wave bands.
Yeah,
what?
All the music that I was coming across during that era, you know?
What was it about hip-hop and rap music? Because some of the people you mentioned there are kind of emerging hip-hop and rap artist. What was it about hip-hop that caught your ear?
I just liked the music. I liked what the rappers were saying, and I loved the beats. And so, falling in love with rap music, I learned about sampling and sample-based culture. And that was really exciting, learning that that these records that I loved were made by taking little pieces from these old soul, jazz, rock records and making something new out of them and then adding vocals on top. So through that process of learning about, the sample world, sample-based culture, I started digging into the roots of music and learning where these producers were finding their tracks from. And then like a group like The Specials or English Beat, they were drawing on the music of 60s Jamaica. And I found out like an artist like Bob Marley, he just didn't have, he wasn't fully formed as an artist with, chest length dreadlocks. That in the early 60s, he was making ska music and he had short hair and he wore like dapper suits.
Amazing ska music, by the way.
Yeah.
Everyone loves this, I think most people, I shouldn't say everyone, because it's not everyone, but a lot of people know Bob Marley for the sort of the way you describe him.
Oh,
just
the
now.
Legend era, the greatest hits,
But I love, more than anything, I actually love those ska records he made.
Yeah, I love them too, and I love the early reggae stuff that he did with Lee, with the Wailers did with Lee Perry.
Yeah.
And I love his, Island Records era stuff as well. So you're just learning about the roots of music and how it's evolved, since the sort of the 50s or what have you. That was going on, and I started DJing. So I'd go out in my quest to find records that I could DJ, and I'd uncover all sorts of stuff. And I had a girlfriend at the time whose father was Jamaican. It had a record store in Scarborough, Ontario, in the 70s. Had a record label as well.
What were they called?
It was called Ron Liu Records. And he wasn't present in the family, but had left his records behind. And that, to me, was like a huge musical education. And Tanis was open and sharing the records with me. And these are the types of records I'm playing in the clubs of Vancouver in the mid-1990s, like really obscure black music, soul, funk, and reggae. And really got me, it was like a huge learning curve. Like, I wasn't just listening to James Brown, I was listening to some pretty obscure regional acts from the States and in some hardcore, like white label Jamaican blanks, things that like you would not have access to at a local record store. So that was fantastic, and it really sort of like upped my musical ante. I was working at HMV Music in the mid-1990s as well, when it was a little bit less corporate. We were able to bring in all this incredible music, import CDs from Japan and Germany. So I was just immersing myself in music and getting into vinyl culture and going out to flea markets and thrift stores and record stores, any place that had vinyl. And I feel really blessed to be mentored by a fellow named Ty Scammell. And he was an old Vancouver hippie from the 1960s. In the 60s in Vancouver, there was a big hippie scene. Mm. It was a great psychedelic rock bands and artists, and it was a really happening scene. This fellow Ty, in the 1990s, he was selling vinyl records out of the Red Barn Flea Market. Listeners out there might know, who have been to Vancouver, the Red Barn Flea Market, still there on Main and Terminal. And Ty's stall was stocked with music of all different styles. He was very, very knowledgeable and turned on a lot of musicians and DJs and just music lovers to all sorts of great music. He focused on psychedelic music from around the world, psychedelic music from Brazil, psychedelic music from Canada. But he really helped shape my aesthetic into looking for Canadian music. And we're not talking about Gordon Lightfoot and the Guess Who and Leonard Cohen, Neil Young, artists who we all celebrated and love and have the records. But he got into this idea of looking for sort of uncharted Canadian music, things that hadn't really had the right opportunity back in the 60s or 70s to reach their rightful audience or were more regional. So I'd start buying these types of records from him and just really became interested in this notion of, underground Canadian music. And as this is all evolving, I started doing music journalism as well, working for the Georgia Strait newspaper in Vancouver, the Alternative Weekly, and started hitting the road, actually getting in the car, often with a good friend of mine, Dane Goulet, also known as Bird of Prey. He's a rapper by the name of Bird of Prey.
It's a good rapper. I like Bird of Prey.
Yeah, he's still rapping. He's still doing his thing. He's based out of Winnipeg now, but originally an East Vancouver kid from the Commercial Drive area. Mm-hmm. We became good friends sort of in the,
He had some... he was affiliated with like the Peanuts and Corn people.
Yeah, he was. Yeah, I think that was sort of maybe prompted the move to Winnipeg, where I think Peanuts and Corn were based out of Winnipeg, McEnroe and Pipsqueak and all sorts of different artists on that scene.
Yeah, yeah.
It was really thriving in underground rap. But me and Bird would like hit the road and like just start digging, and we'd go into the prairies and
you'd hit the road just to look for records?
Yeah, just to look for records. It's hard to find records sometime in a big city. There's lots of competition. It's pretty picked over, but we'd find by like traveling, we'd be able to find things.
I don't know.
Incredible things. Also regional music, like Vish thinking like about the music of the 60s and 70s, a lot of it. And the stuff I was really looking for, I discovered that it was regional records that didn't make it out of a little town, in Saskatchewan. And these are the types of records, I still look for. And I still, I do a lot of traveling across the country looking for records.
Have you heard of Discogs.com?
I have heard of Discogs.com. I've also heard of Gem.com.
Right.
And I've heard of eBay.com.
So does that stuff not help you? Like, they've got a lot of stuff.
Yeah, they have a lot of stuff. But even this thing called the internet, I have found that there's a lot of stuff that's not even on the internet.
No, come on. Everything's on the internet.
Well, the music I'm looking for is not just rare, but I'm looking for still relevant sounds that are off the grid. Not everything is documented online.
Right.
And it's also a motivator for my work. And something in terms of taking it right into the Native North America Volume 1, I found, finding some of these records in my travels and just being blown away by them. The quality of the music, the feeling, the sentiments that were being shared, the culture, the spirituality. I'd be blown away by a record and look online for, let's say, Alexis Yutatnak, who lives in Baker Lake. And I couldn't find out anything about Alexis.
No, wait, just one step back here. You mentioned a name there, and there's a bunch of names here that I didn't know. I'm listening to this thing, and I'm just blown away by every song. I'm just like, what the? And a lot of it has sort of, I don't know, you can hear its impact, and I'm sure that the people making this kind of music don't even know, because I doubt they've heard this, but you can, it's amazing how timeless some of this is. It's amazing how it crosses realms of what we would call indie rock or independent music and mainstream folk music or whatever, rock music. Like this is such an eclectic collection of people making really inventive music. You mentioned a name there that I'm not that familiar with. How did you first become familiar with that name to look it up?
Well, in my travels looking for these records, and I've been doing this for 20 years now, and I think I initially started buying records made by our indigenous peoples maybe like 15 years ago. Willie Dunn was a big catalyst. He is probably one of the most well-known names on the compilation in indigenous music circles. He is regarded as, I've heard many First Nations people say, he was our Leonard Cohen. He made films for the National Film Board out of the Challenge for Change program mm-hmm. in the late 1960s, something that Duke Redbird was also involved with, and Alani Sobomsuin. But an artist like Alexis Yutatnak, I just found his record in my travels. He recorded, or was recorded by the CBC in the 1970s for broadcast play, for regional broadcast play.
Was this for our home and native, or our native land? Or
I think, no, in the 70s, it may have been utilized on that program, but to my knowledge, it was the CBC had a mandate for recording Canadian talent. They had a series of they had a series called LM, Light Music,
right,
which was pop rock stuff. They had SM, which was serious music, which was classical music, getting into like your Glenn Goulds and different Canadian composers. And they also had NS. These are the prefixes that you'd see on a record label that had a CBC logo on it. NS is Northern Service, and it was recording a lot of indigenous talent, people like Alexis. And these records were exclusively made for broadcast play. They were not sold in retail stores. Occasionally, at some point, I think they may have been sold in CBC gift shops, but they were for broadcast play. They'd be sent around to all the CBC affiliate stations across the country and around the world. But even with that distribution, I think they were only really played regionally. Like Alexis's music would be played in the northern regions of Canada. I don't think it was played in Toronto.
These were pressed on vinyl?
These are vinyl recordings. Yeah, pressed on vinyl. It just goes to show you the funding that was available for independent artists in those days, you know, as promoted by the CBC.
So they would press, I don't know, what, 500, 600 of these, maybe 1,000 copies?
Yeah, I think maybe 100 to 500.
Okay, and they just distributed them. They were only available to the people at the stations.
The people involved with the CBC and the radio stations. These are the things that you would see if you were at the CBC Music Library. In the last couple of years, they have been decommissioned, so the CBC don't really have a lot of these records. But over the years, they've trickled out. You'd find them in thrift stores. You'd find them at record dealers' homes. You'd find them at producers or musicians. I guess they would also give copies to the artist.
Do you remember where you first found, like where it was that you first found one of these records?
Oh, this is going back to, oh man, like in the 1990s. And like I was raised in Canada and grew up with the CBC. So when I was out looking for records and I'd see a CBC logo on a record, it piqued my interest. And then in actually listening to the music and finding there were some very interesting titles recorded by the CBC in those days, I'd want to know more about the artists, like, let's say, Alexis Utetnak, or even like other artists like Beverly Copeland or Perth County Conspiracy, folk, pop rock, psychedelic jazz artists. A lot of jazz music was recorded by the CBC and Radio Canada International in those days. And I just started grooving on these records. But when I fall in love with a record, I want to know more about it. Who is this artist? Where do they come from? How did they make this record?
Yeah.
But I found in a lot of cases, especially with the indigenous artists, there was no information. Google Alexis Utetnak, 10, 15 years ago, and you wouldn't find a thing.
Right.
So through my work as a music journalist, and then I've worked with Light in the Attic Records for 11 years or so producing reissues, I realized early on that, maybe obviously, if you want to know about these artists and these songs, you have to go directly to the artists themselves. So I'd put on my Sherlock Holmes hat and I'd try to find these artists, some were more difficult to find than others. Some are just a matter of looking up in the phone book and calling them. And when I'd reach out to the artist, first and foremost, I'd thank them for their music that had affected me in a positive way and inspired me to want to learn more to thank the artists.
And
to ask for much needed context.
Right.
And in a lot of cases, I think people would be scratching their heads. They're like, who's this kid and why does he want to know about this record I made 30 years ago?
Well, you found someone in the liner notes. You talk about this. Most of the people that you spoke to for context in this collection, it was mostly over the phone, right?
Well, in a lot of cases, but I was able to connect face-to-face with quite a few of the artists. But unfortunately, because of the vast geography of Canada and travel costs, like going from Montreal to Salawit in Nunavik in northern Quebec, the round-trip flight is $3,000.
Yeah.
I live very humbly, so it's outside of my means. So the phone and computer was a great connector, even Facebook. A lot of people in the northern regions are active on Facebook. It's a good connector for those isolated geographically. And some of the artists from the Inuit artists, they had told me the names they had for Facebook and the internet was the Great Radio. I thought that was really cool. Interesting.
That's heartening, actually.
And to show the power of radio in those days as a connector and a way to pass out along information and music. A lot of these artists were listening to radio in the 1960s, and that's how they first fell in love with music and wanted to make music on their own.
You actually found someone via a local radio station.
I did, and that was in Baker Lake. And looking for an artist, one of the vocalists and guitarists for a group called Sugluck from Salawit, Quebec, a town that used to be known as Sugluck. So they had some hometown pride in their name, calling themselves Sugluck, but Tayara Papigatuk, he had relocated to Baker Lake, and I couldn't find him. He didn't have a phone number. I tried calling relatives, connecting with people on Facebook. I'd send out messages asking his bandmates. Nobody knew how to get a hold of him. So in my process of, with my Sherlock Holmes hat firmly in on the top of my head. I thought it was like a sort of like a long shot chance I'd start calling municipal offices, and maybe they had records of the people, you know, in the smaller communities. I called the Baker Lake Community Office, the town office, and a very helpful lady there recommended that I call the radio station, the local radio station. I called the local radio station and said I was looking for Tayara. And she said, okay, let me take your name and number. And she put out a message over the airwaves in Inuktitut.
Just made an announcement.
Announcement, yeah. in their native language, which I do not speak. And said that Kevin Howes is looking for Tayara. Please give him a call. I hung up the phone. I thanked
her.
Did
they announce your number on the phone, on the radio?
Well, I wasn't listening. I hung up the phone, and I thought that was it. I went to work and worked on something else, or even just as slipped my mind. But a couple hours later, I'm sitting at my desk and the phone rings. I pick it up thinking it's a friend or family member, and it was Tayara from the Sugluck band, whose music I'm a huge, huge fan of. It's one of the first garage rock, heavy garage rock, hard rock bands from the northern regions of Canada, and it was Tayara. I couldn't believe it. Like, I was flabbergasted.
Great radio. The original Great Radio.
A great connector, yeah. It was incredible. And shows the power of music as well. It was incredible to speak with Tayara. I thanked him for his music and told him that I work for Light in the Attic Records and I'm producing a compilation of indigenous folk and rock music. And please tell me about your band, you know. And we spoke for a while. He told me, you know, all sorts of stories for a half an hour about the band, an hour. We were on the phone and...
Wow.
And I thanked him, and that was incredible. So this is one story on how I would connect with some of these musicians. It was really cool. Like, for me, I'm a non-Aboriginal person myself, and this project has been a great learning experience. I'd never had the opportunity to speak to an Inuit before, and through this project, it's been a great connector. You know, it's bridging cultures, generations, and eras of technology from the analog age to the digital world that we live in today. And it's a great honor for me to be involved in this and to help share these recordings that I feel are very timely, very important, and should be heard.
In speaking with the artists that have now been, you know, their work has now been compiled here, did you get a general theme emerging in the conversations about how well represented they felt their music was before this, or, you know, what their sort of artistic lives were like?
Oh, most definitely. It's been very edifying, and I've tried to transfer as much of that information in all the interviews I conducted with the artists who are still alive in the liner notes. The CD set comes with a 120-page booklet. Mm-hmm. The vinyl box set comes with a 60-page book, and sharing these stories is translated to me and told to me by the artists. I think it was difficult. Music in those days, the late 50s, is really the birth of the Canadian music industry. Things were very regional, and even with the CBC artists who recorded for the CBC, I think their music was only really played regionally, and actually still played in certain communities today. A lot of these artists are very well known in indigenous music circles, but just for any number of reasons, didn't have the exposure on a wider scale. Today we're in a digital world, and music can easily be shared around the world. So there's interest in this project from England, let's say, America. The label, ironically enough, that's putting out this and documenting this Canadian music history is from the States, Light in the Attic Records, out of Seattle and Los Angeles. And Duke might be able to speak on that.
If he's done his game of pool.
I think Duke is...
He's gesticulating over there. He's probably talking about great pool victories past.
But that's one cool thing about this project as well, that some of the artists are still active in music today, and they're still making records, and they're still performing live. And I hope that this project, this Native North America Volume 1, can raise awareness of what these artists have done and what they're currently doing today, which is really exciting. And hearing the feedback from the artists, to me, that's everything. When I can give a copy to Duke Redbird, and Duke tells me, "Thank you, you've done a good job." That's all I need to hear. Like, I'm not concerned with sales. I'm not concerned with distribution. But it, for The Light in the Attic, you know, it's the music business. They have to sell copies of this record. If everyone just downloads it for free, I've already seen the compilation available on blogs for downloading. Which is wild, and I maybe shouldn't say that, but it leaked like really early on. And but if people don't actually go out and support this, we won't be able to do more volumes of it. So if people have the means and the interest, I do encourage people to support their local independent record retailer and go out and buy this.
It's beautiful. I'm seeing you holding it lovingly.
Well, I put a lot of love into this project. I gave everything I had for 5 years to pay my respects to these musicians, this music, and to learn more. Obviously, a process that will continue throughout my whole life, and something I'm very passionate about: documenting Canadian music history, all different styles of music. It's about the music first and foremost for me. I approach this project as I would approach any other project I've done with Light in the Attic or any I'll do in the future. It's all about the music.
You bring this up, I assume, because you have a slight fear that this music might be, I'm not suggesting the music was disposable in the first place, but it mm-hmm. I don't think it was given its due. And you're kind of talking about people distributing it for free and maybe, again, maybe it's going to suffer the same fate. I feel like you've got
that
fear.
You never know, but I know I'm really sensing that the record came out last week, and there's been a real positive, there's been a lot of positive support about it.
Yeah.
From my peers, from people I don't know, have never met, from the media, from the artists themselves. So I want this to be a positive thing for everyone and a celebration. And, you know, like the whole downloading thing, like that's even a conversation for, we could have a whole show just based on that. I'm sure you may have even done a whole show based on these types of concerns and issues.
It comes up here and there.
Yeah. But bottom line, the work on my end for this, which is really almost just starting in a way because I want to raise awareness about it, but, you know, the research and that stuff, you know, we've completed this project. It's a triple vinyl box set, 34 songs with 23 different artists and groups that represent a wide variety of First Nations, Métis, and Inuit players, mm-hmm. a lot of distinct cultures represented. I think it's... there's always struggles for the independent artist, whatever their medium is, for visual artists, for musicians, for poets, for what have you. I think a lot of the issues that these artists were singing about in the 60s and 70s and early 80s, they're still very pertinent today, just looking at the state of the world and the state of Canada. And it's been really interesting learning more about like the country that I call home and have for my 40 years. Learning more about the roots of the country in general and our brutal past.
Yeah.
And the history of our Indigenous peoples. And some of the things that the artists are singing about, I feel, are very, very pertinent and very, very timely. And I hope they can create a dialogue and, you know, we can learn from these artists and these songs.
Yeah, it's one of the most punk rock things I've ever heard.
That's interesting.
Does that make any sense?
Well, Willie Mitchell, one of the artists on the compilation, described Sugluck as his favorite Arctic punk band.
Yeah.
And they have a real hard edged garage rock sort of sounds and attitude.
The whole feeling about it, I mean, hearing Willie Dunn's songs, as well. I mean, there's just this power to them, and it's you can just tell it's coming from a place of fighting something.
Yeah, there's struggle in these songs. There's pain,
but it's also
there's also joy and love, and peace and awareness and understanding. It almost gets into the spiritual for me. Mm. Even as a non-Aboriginal person, I'm learning so much from these artists and what they're laying down, and I think a lot of people feel the same way and want to learn more.
We seem to, this has come up a few times, it's come up a couple of times even on this show, based on conversations I've had with A Tribe Called Red or Tanya Tagaq or Thomas King or Joseph Boyden or whoever. There's this feeling, and maybe we're on the other side of it, that this idea of there being an awareness of native issues, or more of an appreciation for that the cultural contributions. It feels like that has been heightened of late. Do you have a perspective on that? Do you feel like we're paying more attention and appreciating?
Well, I think people want to celebrate like real Canadians that are doing, that are being progressive, that are questioning things, that are creating incredible art, regardless of cultural background. But in the 60s and 70s, there was a movement amongst Native peoples, a lot of empowerment, a lot of Native pride going on, and I hope and see echoes and reverberations of that in things like Idle No More, and yeah, the music that's coming out of the Indigenous music scene, people like A Tribe Called Red and Tanya, who you've mentioned. I really like an artist from Kittagong Zibi called Gabe White Duck. Mm-hmm. I've heard some of his music. It's really excited me. Even though I spend a lot of my time looking back into the past for musical inspiration, because I find a lot of current stuff, especially in the more in the indie rock sort of side of things, is very retro minded and very derivative, not a lot being said.
Yeah,
the type of stuff that these artists on Native North America were laying down back in the 60s and 70s, speaking about the current issues of the day and what's happening. You know, there's a lot of still a lot of just like middle of the road, you know, stuff. People aren't really talking about that stuff in the music that I'm hearing. But
well, there's a certain artfulness that comes through on this compilation in terms of people addressing issues and yet doing so in a timeless way. You know, on some level, they sound like they're of a time. And you know, and you read through the liner notes, they certainly are from, as you say, this spans from 1966 to 1985. But it's all, it has resonance. Like I completely can relate to everything that's going on here. And I think that's not something to shortchange.
Not at all.
It's visionary.
They were of the moment. These artists were of the moment, but also very ahead of the time too. And it's sad to say that, you know, these issues are still with us today, but it seems like nothing has changed, unfortunately. And something I've discussed with Duke over the last few days, Duke, how are you doing over there?
Good.
Yeah,
do you want to join us?
Join the conversation here. We'd love to.
What's he? Is he making a sandwich?
Did you win the pool game?
Oh yeah.
Okay.
And he said, "Oh yeah," just like no sweat. What are you making over there, Duke?
I'm just eating a biscuit.
He's eating a biscuit. All right. We'll have Duke join us in a second. Duke, do you want to pull up a chair? You need help? Are you okay? Okay.
How's it going?
Good.
What
yeah. Do, good
what
test.
Do, what, do, what would you like to know?
We were just talking about the timelessness of the content on this compilation and how it seems to, lately, of late anyway, there seems to be a greater appreciation and acknowledgement of Native issues in music by younger artists. And we were wondering if you had any perspective on that, on the fact that the things that are being discussed here in the 60s, 70s, and 80s are still relevant today.
Well, yes, they're relevant because very little has changed. There hasn't been much improvement in terms of the social fabric of the First Nations, and our relationship to government is pretty well the same as it was back 100 years ago, not just in the 60s. Young people are revisiting simply because they are more aware of the issues nowadays. The Idle No More movement brought about some focus on some of these issues. The murdered and lost women that has been in the news. The whole residential school history, very black history, dark period of Canadian policy, and more younger people are seeing that these are issues that they themselves are dealing with on a day-to-day basis, and they're also revisiting the music of Bob Dylan, of Joni Mitchell, of the early blues and rock. So it's not just the native voice that's being heard, but it's a voice of a generation who had an idea that we could change the world, only to find out that we were the world and there was no change.
So when you talk about the fact that very little has changed, and sort of it's a complex issue on some level, but from your perspective, what would be required to effect positive change?
Well, that we move out of the 19th and 20th century into the 21st century. I mean, there are simple things that could affect immense change if the government and the policymakers had the courage to implement them.
What are such things? Can you talk about them?
Guaranteed annual income. Everyone should have a guaranteed annual income. Why is it only the prisoners in this country, only the criminals have a guaranteed annual income? How is it that only the criminals have food and shelter and access to education and everything else? The reason that the criminals have a guaranteed annual income is because they are commodities occupying cells that support a justice system that has no justice associated with it. A guaranteed annual income for every Canadian would overcome a lot of the problems that are associated with the marginalization of groups like First Nation people. So that's an example. Free market democracy, using our cell phones and technologies to have one vote, one person, one vote. I mean, this is all stuff that has to happen. We can't continue to have representative government from an 18th century idea that no longer works. The whole retribalization through electronic, technological, cybernetic society that's emerging into an electronic retribalization process is what has to happen. And we are speaking to that as we are experiencing and using the social media that we have available to us, and it's coming more and more and more. One day, maybe 5 years from now, I'll be able to send my drone out to speak to your drone, and we'll be able to communicate with each other, and we can talk about the real issues, not the way the government has caused or created a prison of grass. And that's what we're living in now.
You mentioned earlier this real change would be requires courage. What are people necessarily afraid of?
Change
generally.
That's right. The unknown, and it's the politicians and the people that are living in their imagined realities everywhere that see what's coming down and coming through, especially through technology, because technology changes us. We invent technologies, and then the technologies begin to control what we do. A good example is a cell phone. Everybody is tethered to their cell phone now. It's become an extension of their personalities. And this is going to continue as the technologies now. I mean, we will have wearable technologies. We'll be able to use our wearable clothing to communicate with one another as we're walking down the street. We'll be able to go on our cell phones and type in any kind of message, and that message will appear on our clothing, and somebody else can read it. And, you know, this is like tomorrow. I can go out today and buy a jacket that will do that for me. And
from where?
Any of the there's a number of stores that are actually selling this wearable technology today. Now I don't have I think me and you I think, is one big organization, big store like Hudson Bay Company, that sells wearable technology. Me and you, yeah.
Not you and me, right
now.
Or
maybe it's you and me.
No, wait, me and you? That's a place? That's a store?
No, that's a yeah.
Okay.
It's a company that
I thought you
produced,
were talking about me and you.
No, it's the name.
Okay.
It's, and I it could be you and me.
Okay.
Look it up on Google.
Wearable technology.
Yes, of course.
Are you from the future, Duke?
Yes, I think I am.
You think you are?
Yeah, definitely. But only because I happen to be a First Nation person, and the future was already here when Columbus arrived in 1492.
It's getting a little spooky now. I'm getting a little scared. Really, the future was already in existence then?
Of course.
How's that?
Well, in the Americas, for 70,000 years in the Americas, we had lived with only two motivations that motivated the people in the Americas. That was self-preservation and romance, which includes family, art, poetry, dance, music. It was power and money that was introduced from the Western European, Judeo-Christian, Roman, Greco-Roman, Western European technology that brought money and power, institutions of power. As we move into a retribalized electronic society, money and power, as we presently understand them, are going to disappear, and the new motivations of the future will be what was originally the motivation of human beings in the Americas, which is self-preservation romance.
That does feel like what's happening right now. I mean, I know it's the future, but that actually feels real.
It is totally real.
Relate to that.
Yeah.
We were just talking earlier, Kevin and I, about the devaluing of music even. Mm-hmm. And how the internet, like, you know, Kevin pours his heart and soul into this thing, and, you know, artists like yourselves, everyone's contributed to this thing, and it leaked. It sort of went out, and people heard it and are absorbing it, but they're not paying for it necessarily.
That's right.
Yeah, and so that kind of speaks to what you were just saying, I think, on some level.
And it will continue.
That speaks to their heart.
Yes.
There's a romantic connection to it.
Yes.
But there's no money.
That's right.
You just blew my mind. I had my mind blown just now. Over the years, we've seen incremental change about in terms of the differences between us. We're starting to see this happen. We're starting to see civil rights advancements again over the last 50, 60 years, you know. And we've seen, you know, greater acceptance of homosexual lifestyles. We've seen greater acceptance of races and cultures, but for some reason, indigenous culture and white culture, there always seems to be this divide. You mentioned courage, you mentioned fear of change, but I think the subtext of all of that is that there is this fundamental feeling of, I think, shame and maybe a resistance to really redress some of these issues. Do you see where I'm coming from with this? Can you maybe, from your perspective, talk about why this particular divide has been so difficult to negotiate?
Basically, it's because of the language. English is a binary language, and with a binary language you have two words, actually three words, that don't exist in native languages. Those words are either, or, and why. So only Western Europeans talk about why, which is an abstract idea and a philosophical question has no answer. But they continue to ask the question even though they know that the answer to any why question is a lie. The either or is either we're right and they're wrong, or they're right and we're wrong. If they are right and we are wrong, we know that right always overcomes wrong, so we have to get rid of them before their rightness overcomes us. On the other hand, if we're right and they're wrong, it's our duty to overcome them. And so this has been the philosophy of the Western European mindset when they looked at North American native world, and they saw that they were an agrarian world based upon agrarian values, where they had invented something called money, which was the only thing that they could trust.
Right.
And then they found themselves in the Americas, where people were living in a forager, hunter-gatherer relationship to the universe and did not use money and therefore trusted each other. And the Western European agrarian mentality was able to outmaneuver the hunter-gatherer forager mentality, and it remains today.
Okay. So at the end, I mean, this is two answers you've given now where I think the fundamental issue from your perspective is commerce and greed.
Yes.
And that's what's overpowering any ability to convene.
Well, greed comes about when you can grow your own food and grow an abundance of food and want more and more and more and more.
Right.
Where hunter-gatherer-forager society only assembled and attracted enough around them in terms of artifact that they could carry from place to place because they were mobile people. Agrarians are farmers, and they stick to one particular place, and they build cities, and they build empires around an agrarian economy. But a hunter-gatherer forager economy is based on something entirely different, which is to follow the rhythms of nature and not gather a lot of artifacts.
Right. Well, speaking of rhythms, I want to talk about your contribution to this compilation. There's a poem that you contributed. Can you actually talk about how you're involved in this compilation? I understand that another artist basically put music to a poem of yours.
Yeah. Well,
is that
during this period in the 70s, Curtis Johnny, who's known as Shingus, and I. And Willie Dunn and Winston Watney and other artists were on the folk circuit. I was a poet. I recited poetry. Was a good friend of the folk world of the 70s, and we often performed together. So on this particular occasion, I had written a poem. Shingo said, "Hey, I wouldn't mind putting some music to that poem." So we put out an extended play, little record, and that was the piece of music that Kevin found and enjoyed and liked it, and became a part of this compilation. But my own work is on other CDs.
Okay.
as a poet.
Right. So you're primarily a poet. So the poem is Silver River.
Mm-hmm.
And do you appear on this song per se?
No.
Okay. So it's your words.
It's my words. But I was the co-producer of the extended play that we called Native Country.
Right.
With Shingus. So we were partners.
Okay, you were partners.
Yeah.
Okay. And are there other such instances where artists would take your poetry and translate it into a song?
Well, we did other songs. We did the Ballad of Norval Morso together, for instance. Winston Watney and I did Old Woman, which is where music and poetry was combined. Yeah, we experimented with usually what would happen is I would work with an artist, a singer, they'd play a song, then I'd do a poem, then they play another song, then I'd do a poem. It was like that. It was
like a coffee house kind of?
Coffee house, yeah. Yeah. I worked with Bruce Coburn in the early days. We had a little trio called Abundance to Revolution.
Oh.
Yeah. And I was a good friend of Joni Mitchell's and hung out with, the people in the village.
Right.
All the It was just a time when there was an explosion of talent in Toronto and Winnipeg and Vancouver that was amazing. For a period, it was like Camelot.
Yeah.
It came and it went.
Yeah. Are you still in touch with people like Coburn and Joni Mitchell?
I haven't seen Bruce for a while.
Yeah.
But, and I... I haven't seen Joni for a while, but you know, we whenever we see each other, it's always big hugs and reminiscences. Yeah.
Now, what do you make of what Kevin has done here with this?
Kevin has been a godsend in so many ways, because without Kevin and all of the people associated with this Light in the Attic compilation, it would have disappeared, because certainly I or none of my colleagues of the day had any notion whatsoever or the capacity or ability to put it together. So it's like an amazing expression of such noble aspirations beyond my imagination. Personally, I didn't think it would ever happen. I didn't think anyone cared enough about it. So, like, I have nothing but you know, appreciation and gratitude and the fact that it's out there, because it's certainly going to introduce new life into something that I thought had virtually disappeared.
Now, prior to this compilation, I mean, when you look at the artists involved, some of the songs, do you have many of these records in your collection?
No.
They're gone.
Yeah, this is it. Like, when I think back, we were out there performing, and it never occurred to many of us that it would ever go any further than it did, you know?
Probably never occurred to you to collect it.
No, not at all.
Probably you were moving around so much.
Yeah. Exactly, yeah.
These record collections can be cumbersome. Have you had a chance to listen to the three records, the double CD?
Haven't
had a chance?
No.
Okay, so...
But I will.
So when you scan what's on here, does anything about it surprise you? When you look at who's involved, when you look at some of those songs, do you think, oh my God, I forgot about that?
Well, most of it.
Most of it?
Yeah, yeah.
It's a bit of a blast from the past.
It is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, it's interesting. I mean, I'm pleased that you're pleased.
Well, because it came out of the blue. It was like I get a phone call from, you know, a voice on the telephone suggesting that they were interested in this extended play. And I thought it was of no consequence whatsoever. And I didn't want to even go to the trouble of digging it out, because I thought it was just another exercise in futility. And Kevin kept at it, though. You know, he's like the Raiders of the Lost Ark. He's Indiana Jones. He went right after it and didn't stop till he found the Ark of the Covenant, and there it is.
Now, labels like Light in the Attic, there are many labels like this one on some level. I'm not trying to shortchange them. They're very unique and special, but there's a lot of interest in the past. There's a lot of sort of, as you say, going, you know, being an archaeologist of a musical sort, and digging through the past and re-presenting music that most people would have thought was lost or they were unfamiliar with it. Is there any parallel in sort of native culture where you can think of something like this, where like something that was lost is kind of brought back into the fore?
Well, certainly there's been a resurgence of First Nation culture. There's been a great movement on by a generation now who sees the value of the world of traditional culture. But it's mixed up with a lot of other things, because, you know, the definition of culture is anything you invent, borrow, or discover that satisfies your needs. And so there's a lot of borrowing and inventing and discovering from a diverse world of cultural inputs that have been created a bouillabaisse of sound and expressions. So what is pure or would represent what it was like 500 years ago, that's very difficult to recreate and reintroduce. It is being reintroduced in a different way, in an electronic way, through a retribalization process of, and when I say retribalization, what I mean is that social media allows for people who correspond to the same mythologies to talk to each other.
It's a powerful phrase that I don't know that I've encountered. I enjoy, every time you said retribalization, I enjoy it. I enjoy that it's a nice encapsulation of this moment, I think. Mm. We are being connected, and we are forming a kind of front.
That's
in
right.
terms of how we consume culture together.
Yes.
And I see what you mean there by retribalization.
Good.
It makes sense to me. Kevin, what are you mentioned that the success of this volume will dictate the future of this project?
To some degree, yes. And I just want the music to get out there. I want a dialogue to be created. I hope people think about the messages in these songs. And, you know, regardless of whether they go out and buy it or not, I'm going to continue with my work for as long as I live. I don't make a living from it. I do this because I love it, and I want to share some of the knowledge that I've picked up along the way.
It's important work, and I mean, you've I think audaciously labeled this volume one, even
right.
though it's
no,
quite contingent
sure.
on.
No, it is and it isn't. There's definitely going to be a volume two, and that will feature Native American artists from that same era who are doing the same thing that the artists from Canada were doing, people like Floyd Westerman, A. Paul Ortega, etc. So that's happening. I'm currently in production on an anthology of Willie Dunn's music and films.
Amazing.
Like Duke, a true trailblazer from this sort of era of the 60s and 70s and 80s. And you know, obviously, after just hearing what Duke's been laying down, like it's right into the present, the future.
Yeah.
So it's, unfortunately, we lost Willie Dunn in, I believe, August of 2013. I'd like to give a big shout out to his family. And it's another motivator for my work as well. We're all getting older. But I think it would be a real shame if we lost some of this incredible history.
I agree.
Because, you know, we haven't reached out or, you know, it's, I'm just going to keep doing my work, and I hope good things come out of it. I want this to be a positive thing. I want it to be a celebration. But when you're bringing back music from the past, it can bring back the whole gamut of emotion and all the emotions that went into its creation, which can bring back joy, but it can also bring back some pain as well. But I want this to be a celebration, and just to raise awareness of what was going on in those days in Canada, things that, you know, I didn't know about up until I started finding these records and reaching out to the artists and wanting to learn more and then share that. And luckily, like, I have an outlet to do that through my work with Light in the Attic Records, and I view it as an honor for me to be able to do this.
The first thing I saw in terms of anything connected to this compilation was a promo video. It was on YouTube, and it looked like it might be a preview for a documentary. But was that the extent of it? Was it just creating a little promo for the record?
Yeah, we wanted to raise awareness about these artists and their music and to promote the forthcoming album, which just was released last week in late November. But we shot extensive interviews with Willie Thrasher in Nanaimo, Willie Dunn, rest in peace, in Ottawa, and also Willie Mitchell in Kitigan-Zibi, sort of Maniwaki in Quebec. So we'll see how things unfold.
You have more footage. I mean, this could
there's more footage and this, these artists and this story. And by default, we're not able to include all of the incredible talent that was active in that era. You could have 20 volumes and still be putting out more albums. But I wanted to showcase the breadth of what was happening in those days and records that spoke to me as well and that I thought were incredible enough to want to share. I don't think everything from the past is worthy of a reappraisal in this manner. But the songs that are still relevant and still pertinent, I think it's important that we hear them. You know, if music lovers can hear them, you know, it's fantastic.
Yeah, that's just it. I mean, beyond the context of this, like, the music's incredible. Like, I am enjoying just listening to this thing.
Well, otherwise, like, we probably wouldn't be a project. Like, the music is, I approach this project no different than I would working on the projects of Sisto Rodriguez or working with Thin Lizzy or Doug Randall, a CBC composer, arranger, the 6-album Jamaica to Toronto series that I put together for Light in the Attic. It's all about the music and the power of music, and it's nice to see people responding to it and dialogues being created about it and, you know, thoughts being exchanged. It's fantastic.
No, it is. Well, I wish you all the luck in the world with this thing, and I thank you, Duke and Kevin, for being on this program. Is there a song from the compilation that we can point people to? No, we have a lot of options here, but is there something?
Well, why don't we try the song Silver River?
Sure.
By Shingus, featuring poetry, the poetry of Duke Redbird.
Now, Duke, I didn't get a chance to ask you this. Is there anything about Silver River that you can tell us?
Yeah, the poem itself, when I wrote it, it was like the words talk about there were rapids in a silver river and shoals made of turquoise, and the rapids were silent and the shoals were not visible, and the girl with sweet grass in her hand and corn silk in her hair placed the silver river on her little finger and took the rapids to her bed. It was representative, really, of the era in which we lived and were engaging not only our personal relationships but also life, which was the Silver River, you know, and it was the whole notion that it was part of a dreamscape, I guess, and I felt that it was representative of a kind of a gentle, beautiful world, particularly when this Mother Earth woman placed the Silver River on her little finger. You know, these images were just very poetic, very lyrical, and something that everyone could relate to, because it didn't specifically address a particular genre or a particular group or anything. It was just a nice thought.
Do you remember sort of where, what, and when might have when this idea came to you?
Well, I was in Yorkville, the song itself was composed about the time when I was living in a boarding house across the hall from Joni Mitchell.
Oh.
I think that there was a bit of an inspiration there with the corn silk in her hair. You
oh,
know?
Interesting.
Yeah.
So Joni might have had a part in this.
Yeah, I think so.
Nice.
Very, very much so, yeah.
Does she know about that?
I think she does. There was a book written it was mentioned.
Okay.
Girls Like Us, the book was called.
Right.
And it's about Joni's life in Toronto and her later career. And I figure, rather prominently, I'm glad to say, because I just had one of those beautiful opportunities to meet an incredible artist the moment that just before she burst onto the scene with such magnificent talent, and it was great to have those moments, you know, you meet people of that era and that talent, but it was all around, it was everywhere, you know. Gordy Lightfoot was playing at the Riverboat,
right.
And Murray McLaughlin was, you know, strumming his guitar and in on the steps and coffee houses in Yorkville. And Sonny Terry and Brownie McGee were always coming into town, and they'd put on a great show and then argue with each other for the rest of the night, you know. And there were people like Blind Lemon Jefferson and great blues, these incredible blues singers. They were walking around Yorkville. Just, you know, I saw Earl Father Hines hanging out. And this city was just a hotbed of immense talent, you know, on any given day. I remember when I wrote a poem about it. One day, Leonard Cohen and Ramblin' Jack Elliott and I are sitting in the Lothian Muse, and we're just having a great afternoon together and talking. And I wrote a poem about it. You know, that was the way it was, and it all died with the developers coming in and taking down the great old coffee houses,
right,
and putting up their steel and glass condominiums.
Well, on that note, let's go to the the more pleasant visions of Silver River. And I'll let people know that for more information on Native North America Volume 1, they can go to lightintheattic.net and please pick up this thing because it's great. And as Kevin said earlier, support your independent record stores and go pick up the vinyl or the CD. They both are nice. They're lovely. So thank you both for being... Duke, Kevin, thank you so much for being on the show, and I wish you the best.
Thank you.
Thank you, Vish. It's been great speaking with you today. Peace.
We say in Ojibwe, thank you, Megwetch.
To the future.
Absolutely.
Which might be now.
It is.
There were rapids in a silver river.
To her bed.
Hey, thanks again for checking out Creative Control with Vish Khanna. You can email me about the show at creativecontrol933@gmail.com. That's creative with a K, control with a K, 933@gmail.com. You can also follow our Twitter at Vish Creative, VishKreative. And you can also like our Facebook page. A version of this show airs on CFRU in Guelph every Wednesday at noon Eastern. And you can listen to that online at CFRU.ca or if you're in the KW region at 93.3 FM in Guelph. You can also sign up for the weekly mailing list for the podcast and the show at vishkhanna.com and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. I believe that is everything I wanted to tell you. Thank you once again.